And Dave here, Super Dave, that's, I thought about him all year. You know, it's just, it's great. You know, he's invited me up to Colorado to share his condo with him. Well, okay, honesty. He told me to stay the hell out of Colorado, much less Denver. But that's enough about Dave and I. And there's a man here who wrote a chapter in the big book, and I finally read it. No, I'm just kidding. But it's Physician Hill, myself, and Earl Lynn.
Holy Christ. My name is Earl, I'm an alcoholic. Do it again. My name is Earl, I'm an alcoholic. Jesus. I was warned by several people that I'm in trouble because people here are a little bit right of center, and I'm too liberal, and I better get the hell out of here as soon as I get a finish talking. Whatever I say here that sounds too liberal, to those who are conservative, I say it serves you right.
Is that all right?
You know, being in Northeast Texas reminds me of the 1955 International AA Conference held in the Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis. Some of you were probably there. And Ikey Sheridan, famous Texan. Some of the old timers here may remember Ikey, close friend of mine, and he was the first alcoholic. Has he got gin in it? Oh, this one has. Okay, thank you. He was the first alcoholic trustee on the General Service Board, and the night that Bill turned over AA to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he stepped away. Bob had since died. Ikey introduced him. This is a very emotional evening. Bill's mother was on the stage, and Lois was there, and all the big shots were there. And Ikey told the following story about your area here. He said that, I can't imitate his Texas twang, I wish I could. He said, in Northeast Texas, we have a little town, but they had no place to put a drunk if one showed up. So they decided that if one did show up, and of course one did, they'd put him in the ice house. This was the days when they had the big little green ice house with the big handle from the door. So they put one in there. That evening, the sheriff was sitting at his dinner table, and all of a sudden, he stood bolt upright, and he said, "Oh, Emmy, I left old Joe down there in the ice house. I've got to go down and get him out. He'll freeze to death." So he put on his hat and he walked down the street, got to the ice house and turned the big handle. A door creaked open like that, and way over in the corner sat a little drunk all huddled up. And he looked up at the sheriff and he said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." And so am I, by the way. In Texas, I guess you got to tell the sobriety date. My sobriety date is June 15th, 1953. And one day at a time. I started to drink my alcoholism. Let me speak as a physician. I am one. Let me speak as a physician for a moment. Alcoholism, all addictions, by the way, are the same. They're all the same. We're all the neurotransmitters. We're all affected in the same way. We have division in AA, and I'm sure there is here. There is in California, where I come from. Let's say that a certain drug addict should not be admitted to AA meetings. Now, I'm not getting into that. You've got to settle that yourself. Anyway, we do know that from a scientific standpoint that the vast majority, maybe not all, but the vast majority of addiction of all kinds is a family inherited susceptibility. My own father was alcoholic, so was my mother. She wasn't as severe as my father, but she got She was periodic. She got drunk two or three times a year. When she did hug the wall, she was coming through. I mean, that's what she meant. I had an uncle that died at the age of 47 from alcoholism. I had a cousin that died at the age of 30 from alcoholism. That's all on my mother's side. I have one cousin on my mother's side who, by the way, has been in AA about, oh, I guess 13 or 14, maybe 15 years. And then my father's side, they're all drunks on my father's side, a whole bunch of them. So I come by my alcoholism justifiably. And I also got addicted to amphetamines, too. And yet not every member of an alcoholic's family become addicted. My brother, he's 18 months younger than I am. He's not addicted, he's an addict. They're not an addict, I am. And we'd go out to dinner on Thanksgiving or Christmas, his wife and mine, my wife sitting right there, Mickey. We'd go out to dinner, and my brother would take a martini. And he would hold it up to the light, and he would let the light sift through it. I don't know what he's doing, you know. And then he would take the martini and put it under his nose to savor the bouquet. And then he would take the martini and sip it. And then have the temerity to sip the damn thing down again. This used to drive me crazy. I'd say, why don't you knock it off? I mean, you know. Well, that doesn't bother me these days, but it did in those days. But you see, the joke was on me. He is a normal drinker. We're a bunch of slobs. You know, the one thing we know how to do well is to drink booze badly. We're slickers at that. This was in the summer of 1926. I was 15. I was born in 1911. 1926. We went to an area known as Russian River. You folks may not know that. Anyone been in California, Northern California, may know Russian River. It's a great resort area. And he and I went up there to taste booze. We had never done this before, never had a drink before. He had a little Ford car, and we went up there, and we went out to a bootlegger. His name was Martinelli. And old Ma Martinelli, she was a big, fat Mamma Mia, you know, big varicose veins and legs. She had eight children, and she was a very gentle soul. She, later, when the prohibition was rescinded, and this is during prohibition, she became the Martinelli Winery. And they still make Martinelli wine out there, make Martinelli apple juice. So it's from Omaha that we got 4 quarts of red wine. Now, I suppose that the bootleg wine was not as strong as we have it today. I don't really know. We went back to our cabin, and my friend Art sat on one little cot, and I sat on the other. They didn't have buildings. They had tents, the floors of the tent over it. And so we uncorked our bottle, both of us, and started to taste the libation. And I had a couple of drinks of this, and I thought, gee, where's this stuff been? This is pretty good stuff. So I paid attention to this, and I reasonably promptly drank that quart of wine. I looked at Art, and he had drunk about half of his, and he's sitting in bed, bolt upright, eyes wide open, looking out like this, staring into space. I thought the guy had died. So I was frightened. We were only 15, away from home. You know, it was prohibition days. And I said, Art! And it jiggled the air enough so he just plopped over on the bed. I went over and shook him, and I could see he was drunk. I'd seen my own father drunk, and so I knew what it was my mother, too. And so wearily, I put his legs up on the bed and put a comfort over. And then I thought, what'll I do? I never felt so lonely in my life. Then I spied his half-empty, half-full bottle. I said, well, that can't waste that. So I drank it. Then I thought, what shall I do? Remember, I went outside and walked down. It was very light, starlit night, dark, beautiful. Came back in, sat down, and then I spied the other 3 quarts of wine. Believe it or not, no, the other 2 quarts of wine, I sat there and drank the other 2 quarts of wine. Now, that's 3+ quarts of wine and a kid of 15. I don't think it was as strong as we have it today. It's a wonder it didn't kill me, but I was an alcoholic, didn't know it. And my tolerance was very, very high, and that was true my whole drinking career. Now, from that time on, I didn't drink often in my high school and college and medical school. But when I drank just like that, large amounts. Either I didn't drink or I drank large amounts. That's what I did. In 1939, it happened. What happened? They came out with little metal boxes with all kinds of drugs in it, given to us as physicians. Nimbutol, Secanol, Tuinol, and Benzedrine. And I tried them all. See what it was like, you know. And I tried Benny's, and from then on, a great love affair built between Benny's and me and alcohol for the rest of my drinking days. Well, I'm not going to go into my drinking story, but the same as yours. There's no difference. I must say this, though. I never endangered a patient. I had a very thoughtful partner, and when I drank, I was not on call. I never was in my office drunk, never once, with a patient there. After the last patient left, I went into my office and poured a big drink that I had in the lower right-hand drawer of my desk. And I never was in the hospital drunk. I went in a couple of times and I was kind of whacked up, but I wasn't on call. I had no patient in mind. Now, how long this would have lasted, I don't know. But I never endangered a patient, I'm happy to say. You know, I differ from many alcoholics. One is that I love the taste of alcohol. Now, I love sweet drinks as well as straight drinks. It wasn't the taste so much, it was the burning sensation, going to like this and landing here. I like that sensation. The next thing is, I never lost a thing. I never was arrested. I don't know how I avoided it, but I never was. I never had we call them DWI, driving while intoxicated. Now it's driving under the influence, DUI. Never had one of those. I don't know how I avoided it, but I didn't. I made more money in the last year of my drinking than I ever made before in my whole life. Success killed me. I had everything right by the knockers. It was easy for me. I even got to feeling, and I remember this very well, thinking all good must come from me. I can't help it. I apologize to you, but that's the way I thought. I thought about it. And because I'd had enormous amounts of success in my life, and the skid row of success, believe me, is as bad as a skid row in the street, in the curbstone in the street. Just as bad. As a matter of fact, all bottoms are the same. I'm not talking about physical bottoms now. Physical bottoms do vary. I know yours is prettier than mine, but that's all right. I don't know. Some people go to Skid Row. Only 3% of alcoholics go on Skid Row. 3%. All the rest are next door to you and me. But all the emotional bottoms are absolutely identical. Despair is despair is despair is despair. For example, you know, we all think our emotions are rather unique. Well, in a sense, they are. But we're all the same, really. You know, your pain is the same as mine. Your despair is the same as mine. Your pain is the same as mine. Your suffering is the same as mine. Your joy is the same as mine. We're all the same, baby. You see, we all have the same kinds of emotions. Well, let me get back to the story. On the last day of my drinking, 15th of June, 1953, and so this coming June 15th will be my AA birthday. I went to Sam's restaurant and I ordered a Waring blender full of vodka fizzes and 3 double vodka martinis. Now, why I ordered this mess, I don't know. I like sweet drinks. I used to be ashamed to say I ate candy when I drank. I didn't eat other food, and now and again I eat candy. And I was kind of ashamed. That seemed kind of sissified, you know. I don't know. I read a book by Jack London entitled John Barleycorn. Jack London was an alcoholic and died from booze, and he's the one that popularized the name John Barleycorn. And in there he said when he drank he ate candy, and I said, well, hell, it was good enough for Jack, it was good enough for me, so I forgot it. Well, I drank these down. Now, on this day, I was not completely blacked out. I was kind of browned out. So I'll tell you a few instances. I don't recall leaving Sam's restaurant in Tiburon, a little city near, I live in Mill Valley, California, north end of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I don't recall leaving there, but I recall somewhere in the early afternoon, being up on the side of the mountain, we live on the side of the mountain, visiting a friend of mine named Harry. Harry, who I'd gone to the university with, and I knew him rather well, fraternity brother of mine. And he had been in trouble with booze. Now, I didn't go there seeking sobriety. I had been so worried about my drinking, I could not seem to stop. I know I never considered myself alcoholic. In those days, the word alcoholic was not as popular as it is now. And we all thought, I did anyway, that alcoholics were on Skid Row. 3% only are on Skid Row, and I thought all alcoholics were. So I never called myself an alcoholic. Somebody said to me, are you a drunk? I'd say, well, I don't like the word, but yeah, I am, yeah. Aren't you drinking too much? And I'd say, yes, I do. And they said, well, why don't you stop? And I said, I don't know. I try to. I remember one time on a Sunday I said, I'm not going to drink again. I'm going in the wagon. I tried this many times. I'm going to go in the wagon. So I didn't drink any more that day. On Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, I did not drink. But I came home Friday afternoon late, Friday evening, and I poured out a big glass of vodka and drank it down. As I did it, I said, Earl, as I said to myself, I always talk to myself, I said, Earl, I thought you said you were going to stop drinking. And here I drank it down. I could not stop. I didn't know why. Well, anyway, I didn't go up. On this particular day, I was not concerned. It was one of the good days. And I went up to see Harry, and we talked, and he said, you know, I've been in trouble with booze. And I said, yes, I know that. He'd made the newspapers, and he'd been in jail, and his wife had left him, and I knew all this. But he said, you know, I haven't had a drink for 7 months. And I said, you haven't? What happened to you? Well, he said, do you know of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, well, not really. I said, I read an article by Jack Alexander. I remembered the name. Later, by the way, I met Jack Alexander, and he and I became very close friends. But at this time, he was only a name, a writer. In the Saturday Evening Post in 1941, and he talked about AA, and in there, one of the founders was a doctor. And I, being a doctor, identified with that, and that's all I knew. Well, he said, he gave me a piece of paper like this, and he said, it was a little folded together, you open it up, and on one side, and on this side, there were statements directed towards the active drinker who was planning on stopping drinking. I wasn't planning on stopping drinking on this day. But he gave it to me. I later said to him, when I learned what this word meant, were you 12-stepping me? And he said, no, I wasn't. No, I knew you were a little drunk, I could tell that. But he said, I just gave it to you as a matter of information. Well, the scene changes, and I got home to my house in Mill Valley, and I was sitting on the deck, beautiful sunny day in June, daylight saving time, and I was trying to make this thing out, and I was so drunk, I just couldn't read the words. So I asked my wife if she would come out and read it to me, and she did. And she read one thing that said, don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself, except you. Don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself. Another thing she read was, don't consider yourself a martyr because you stopped drinking. Don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself. And don't consider yourself a martyr because you do so. Now, these two very beautiful statements made a very deep impact on me. As though somebody had taken a wet beer towel and just popped me in the mouth with it. It just shook me. And I broke down and cried. Well, crying was par for the course in those days. You know, I didn't know it then, but do know it very much now, that emotional instability is the result of excess using and drinking. Used to think that emotional instability caused addiction. We now know that's probably untrue. And here I was, I'd drive along, Bing Crosby was very popular in those days. I'd drive along in my car, I'd listen to Bing sing, and I'd cry, you know. Or I'd look up in the sky, I was noticing, I told my wife yesterday, there were beautiful clouds here. I'd see a beautiful cloud, and it would touch me, and I'd cry. Or I'd look up and not see a cloud, and I'd cry, too, maybe, too. I'd look at my wife and daughter, and I'd cry, and I'm sure they looked at me and cried, too, I don't know. Well, anyway, my wife patted me on the back and said, don't worry, you'll be all right, and went in the house. And I sat there, and I don't think I ever felt so dejected, so down, so depressed, so abject in my life. I'm kind of an up guy, and I never felt this way. Well, it soon passed a little bit, and it was about time, maybe it was 4:30, 5, time to build the barbecue fire. We made a barbecue on Saturdays and Sundays. And we lived at the barbecue areas up on the side of the hill up from the house. And I recall sloshing up the stone stairs. I can recall this very well. Getting to the top stair, it must have been 14 or 15 steps. I got to the top stair, looked at my glass, and I had just about a finger left from the bottom of the glass. And I said, now, that will never do. If I'm going to be up there making that fire, I should have a full glass. So I'll turn around the stairs and go down onto the deck and go into the kitchen, make a drink, come out on the deck, up the stairs, out of the barbecue pit, and I'll have one there. As I turned around on the stairs, an absolutely phenomenal thing happened to me. I had no concept that this was going to happen, and it did. Now, I really can't describe it, but I'm going to try. As I turned around, it was as though an explosion occurred inside of me. It just ripped me apart. I felt pain in every cell of my body. Now, I have no idea why. I'm a physician, and I can't account for it, but I did. I felt acute pain. And then I heard the words, "This is your last drink." That was a surprise to me. It got to me. I took what little I had in the glass and poured it out. And then a second thing happened to me. I felt enormously relieved. Then a second thing happened to me. I suddenly became as clear as I am right this instant. Now, how you come from being a sloppy drunk to total clarity, I have no idea. I can't account for this, but I did. And then for the first time I said, "Oh, you are an alcoholic. That's your trouble. You're addicted to these amphetamines. You're addicted to this booze. That's it. That's why you went to see that psychiatrist. And he didn't help you, and bet. You're a booze artist. That's what you are." Well, I felt enormously relieved. I was joyful that, thank God, I got the seat of all this thing. At that instant, the craving to take another drink disappeared from me, or a pill, disappeared from me, and has not returned for 37 years, even once. Now, that's kind of remarkable. I don't know what to make of this. I didn't know what to do. I realized that I should go to AA, so the next day I went up to see Harry, and Harry took me to an AA meeting. In those days, in this county where I live, there are only 3 meetings. My God, we have 300 now. And I went to the meeting, Harry took me, and I realized I was an alcoholic. Let me tell you about the first meeting. I went in the meeting, and there was like a banquet table, 4x8 table. And on this side sat a guy named Clark Billingsley, long since dead. On this side sat a little guy named Shorty. I won't give his last name because he's still alive. Shorty. And Clark was a butcher. Shorty, little short, irritable, bald-headed guy, was a carpenter. On that end of this edge of the table, the other side of the table, sat a guy named Vern Weir, long since dead, who was a baker. And on this side sat my friend Harry, who was kind of a self-styled inventor, and me. That's all. We had very small meetings in those days. Well, that Vern was a baker, and Shorty was a carpenter, and Clark was a butcher. And now, if there's any carpenter, butcher, baker here, please, I'm not slurring them. But let me say what happened to me then. My idea is totally different now. The great doctor pulled himself up to his greatest height and said, "What am I doing with a butcher and a carpenter and a baker and my friend the mechanic here? What's this?" So I asked Clark if I could be excused. He said, "By all means, doctor." So I walked out of the hall, stood underneath a linden tree, and I took stock. I said, "Earl, you mean to tell me that with all the things you have," and I won't go into all my professional things, they're remarkable, but I won't go into them. "You mean to tell me that this, you have got to go in there to have a butcher and a carpenter and a baker and a mechanic make a man out of you?" And the word came to me, "You're damn right you do. Get in there." So I went in there, and I want to tell you, never has a doctor become so grateful to a carpenter and to a butcher and to a baker and a mechanic as this one. These guys were master clinicians. They know exactly what to say to me. They know exactly what not to say to me. They know how to treat me and when to not treat me. They know how to sit next to me and when not to sit. They were just remarkable people. You know, they just knew how to soothe me I don't know how they got this clinical sense, but they did. They were just beautiful. After several weeks, I heard of another meeting, which I thought was an AA meeting. I found out later it was not, but it was many AA people went to it, mainly AA, I thought. It was known as Jesus as Teacher. And it talked about the teaching statements of Jesus, not his divinity, so-called, but his statements. And was copied after a book written by a man named Sharman. Maybe some of you know the book, Jesus as Teacher. Well, this was really in one-upsmanship group is what it was. It wasn't an AA group, but I thought it was. You know, I didn't know any different. They would come in and someone would say, by the way, have you read what's on page 93, page paragraph 2? And we say, well, no, we haven't read that. You go home and read it. We think, oh, that guy was putting us on. We come back and say, no, but have you read us on such and such a book on page 122? No, he hadn't. And back and forth, this thing went of showing off and proving that you knew more and you're more spiritual. So a lot of other garbage, you know. Well, at the end of 4 months, I felt terrible. Just felt awful. I went to Clark and I said, Clark, you know, I might just as well be drunk as feel like I do. I thought I saw a faint smile go across his face. And he said, Earl, let me get you a cup of coffee and a donut. We served donuts in those days. And I watched him like a child. I watched Shorty and Vern and Clark, just like I was a child, hanging on every word they said. So he got this cup of coffee for me and took me over the corner of the hall at the Methodist Church there. And he sat down, crossed his legs, and looked way off into space. And I sat there in eager anticipation. What was he going to say? He said, you know, Earl, I'm very proud of you. You're a doctor, and it must not be easy for you to come down with us. After all, we aren't schooled like you are. But he said, you know, and you've done well for 4 months. Done well. He said, you know, you're going to this other group, which is perfectly fine. But he said, I've got a statement to say to you. Why don't you join Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, well, Clark, what do you think I'm doing? He said, well, I'm not quite sure what you're doing. But he said, this other group you go to is perfectly fine. Don't give it up. It's all right, you know. But it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe right now it might be wise if you paid attention to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I thought I was doing that. He said, well, I know you did. I know you did. I'm not blaming you at all. I said, Clark, if you're in my shoes, what would you do? He said, well, I don't know what to tell you. But he said, this occurs to me. What, have you read the big book? And I said, yes, I read it 3 times. He said, you don't learn very well, do you? And I said, well, no, I guess maybe I don't. He said, why don't you go home and open up to page 70? Now, in the first edition of the book, we didn't call it chapter 5 or how it works. We called it page 70. That was the affectionate name. Some of the old-timers here will remember that, page 70. And why don't you get up and open and read it? So I said, Clark, I'll do it. I left, went home, opened the big book, and it said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women went on and on. Well, I memorized the 5th chapter and many other parts of the big book that day and later on, and it kept saying, go to any lengths. And it said, half measures avail us nothing. It didn't say half measures avail us half. It said half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Will complete abandon, giving yourself, go to any length, finally sunk through this thick skull. And at that instant, I became more a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have had a joyful / horrible trip in AA. I loved every pain that I have had. Now, let me tell you a few things that occurred to me in sobriety. Now, some of you folks will not like what occurred to me, but I can't help it. It's what occurred to me. And if it steps on your toes, I bow to you and say, pardon me. When I was about, I don't know how far, a few years sober, I got up every morning. I operated every morning very early, and I got up at 4 o'clock and did some exercise, which I still do. Still exercise every morning. Here I am, close to 80. And I get up every morning and exercise for an hour and a half. But I did then. As I stood there that morning, the dawn was just barely breaking, summertime. And I started to cry softly. I didn't know why. I just felt terrible. I went over and sat down on a chair, and I continued to cry. Now, I'm the kind of a person, when I have discomfort, I don't escape it. I don't turn on the radio, turn on the TV to get rid of it. I don't do that. I walk right through it. I want to understand it. I'm interested in understanding it, and still am today. I want to know what goes on inside of me just to understand it. That's all. I thought, what's going on with me? And then I realized that I'd never felt that I'd had a home. I'd never felt I'd had a home. Here I was in my 40s, never felt I'd had a home. Then a thing happened to me and change occurred. Change occurred in this, but a mutation just like that. And all of a sudden it occurred to me that I was incorrect. The only home I could ever have, really, was inside of me. Therefore, I'd been home my whole life. I just didn't know it. Oh, yes, I'd had houses, apartments, condominiums, whatever you want to call them, but I had been home my whole life. I never have been any place but home since that time, as far as my consciousness is concerned. I'm home right this instant. It's inside of me, whatever that may mean. That's it. So I realized that I was home all the time. Loneliness has never struck me since that time, not at all. I realized we all live in solitude. We're all in solitude. You're in solitude, so are you. You're all in solitude, but we're in solitude together. That's kind of a great thing. Well, a couple of years later, I was in Texas. There was a very great man in AA named Chuck C., a very close friend of mine, and he's been up here at this conference for this and talked, I think, in 1967. Mickey and I noticed in the program, knew him very well. And Chuck C. was another guy I followed. I aped him. I worshipped him. I copied. I tried to talk the way he did. I didn't make it, but I tried to ape him. I was always reading books, and they'd say, "Well, do this," and so I would do that. I remember one time I read a book entitled "The Power of Positive Thinking." I'm not criticizing the author, by the way, of the book. And I went around for a whole year smiling all the time, just smiling like that. And I felt like hell. Just felt terrible, you know. At the end of the year, I said, "I'm going to write a book entitled The Power of Negative Thinking." Well, so Norman Vincent Peale, I love you to death, and I'm glad it's been a great help to some people. But I didn't know how to use the book, and it didn't help me at all. I couldn't fake it. I was down, so I've been trying to copy everybody. Oh, God, I was really a second-class citizen. I was a secondary person trying to ape you and you and you and you. Didn't work. And Chuck and I had done lots of public speaking in my medical career, and my AA career I started. By the way, I got to talking so much. Someone said, "You know, we haven't heard of you for years. Where you been?" I said, "I got tired of my own voice." And I quit talking. Now and again, I come to here or some other place, but... And then I was out of the country for many years. I was in Southeast Asia for a long time. Well, Chuck was talking, I was next. And I looked up at Chuck and I said, "Chuck, I love you to death. You are fabulous. You've been of enormous help to me. I'll never forget you. But Chuck, I got to go. I've got to leave. I can no longer be a follower. I've got to be my person. I've got to develop my AA program. See, as far as I'm concerned, there is no hard line in AA, and I know there are many here who think there is, and I appreciate that, and you're correct as far as you're concerned. But don't tell me how to work a hard line program, because I don't think there is one. You work yours, and I'll work mine. I've got to work my own AA program. I can no longer be a follower. I never have followed anyone since that time. I walk my own way. Now, you know, it takes a fair amount of courage to walk your own way in solitude with others, to not be influenced by what others say. They may give you some time, something to think about, and that's fine, okay. Of course, thinking is the thing that kills you anyway, you know. We'd turn off our think box, we'd be all right, you know. So I've never followed anyone since that time, and I've gone my own way. Now, many people don't like the way I've gone. That's too bad. It's the way I've gone. I can't help it. That's the way I did it. Just like it's the way you've done it. So since that time, I have never followed anyone. I've always been at home inside of myself. Now, I got to tell you a thing. It occurred to me in my sobriety. All these are things that occurred to me in my sobriety. Maybe not yours, but mine. It occurred to me that we have it all mixed up as regards time. T-I-M-E, time. And I was able to see that we needed to divide time into emotional or spiritual time and physical time, that is the material world. It became clear to me that it was... In the material world, there is such a thing as time. For instance, it took you folks and me and my wife a certain number of hours or minutes to get here. We've been here a certain length of time, and soon we'll be on our way to where we're going. So there is a past and a present and a future in the material, physical world. No, I could see that. Even there, we kind of mess it up, but that's all right. Now, how does that work in the emotional world? Emotionally speaking, it's always now. There is no time. Physically, there is. Emotionally, there is no time. Now, that being true, you and I are not allotted any time in which to change our emotions. We are out of luck. It's just like alcoholism or drug addiction. There's no way you can change your drug addiction or your alcoholism addiction until you become aware that that's what you are. You're a drunk. Oh, I don't have to control that stuff because I can't. Oh, I see. That's when physical sobriety starts. It's absolutely the same, as far as I'm concerned, with emotions. Recognize your emotions. For God's sake, don't try to change them. Recognize them. Live with them. Understand them. That's who you are. At that instant, emotional sobriety starts. God, most people say, I'm resentful and I shouldn't be. Or I'm jealous and I shouldn't be this way. I'm going to change that. And we're taught in this culture we can change our emotions. It's all wet. It's just cockeyed. You can't. It's wrong. You can't do it. We just struggle and struggle to change our emotions. I'm going to become happy for the rest of my life. I'm going to AA meeting and get happy. You come to AA to get happy? You're crazy. AA meeting is a place you come to get sober. Now, maybe you get happy too. That's fine too. Well, as far as I'm concerned, emotional sobriety only comes after accepting the emotions that you have. You see, be who you are. There's nothing wrong with you emotionally. I don't care what mood you're in right this instant, there's nothing wrong with you. Nothing right with you either. It just is what you is. You is what you is. Be it, and if you do, and you accept it, just like when you accept alcoholism, machinery is set in motion which will bring about emotional change, and it happens in no other way on a durable basis. Now, you can fake emotional change for a while. I did it for a year, otherwise too. You can make yourself say, I'm going to be happy today, and you'll be happy for a while, but the same old business will come back again. Accept what's there. If it's terrible, feel terrible. Don't wallow in it. That's not the idea. Accept it. What's it about? What's going on? Every time you feel terrible and I feel terrible, change is about to happen. Woo! I wrote a paper once for the Grapevine. I had an awful hard time sending it in. I was so worried that people would criticize me and hate me. I don't give a damn if they hate me at all. But I sent it in and it was, thank God for despair. Why, it's been reprinted 7 times in the AA Grapevine, so somebody agreed. Now, what I meant was, I'm not selling despair, not selling pain, not selling discomfort, but I'm saying every time there is discomfort, change is about to happen. Believe me. If you're feeling terrible this morning, happy days. You're about to change into something that'll be kind of good. Be who you are, and the movement of change will happen. God, be who you are, if you don't do anything else. You know, I went to Asia. They got me from the medical school in San Francisco, where I was a professor, to go to the Medical College of Georgia. They offered me a professorship if I would go to Saigon. Saigon. The war was still on. It was tapering down. If I'd go there as a visiting professor and help the University of Saigon Medical School develop its own a new program in my surgical specialty. So I accepted. And I decided to go back to New York, and Bill was a close friend of mine. He and I had the same kind of a great, big, blasting, spiritual, hot flash recovery, so we became very close friends. I went there and spent several days with him and Lois up at their place at Bedford Hills, and finally it got time to go to the airport, and Bill drove me down to the airport, and on the way down he said, Earl, you know, I've been sober longer than anybody else in our organization. Nobody else has been sober as long as I have. He said, I don't feel very serene. I don't have much peace of mind. I said, I don't either, Bill. I don't have much peace of mind either. We cogitated on this for a while. Then we got to the airport. We hugged one another, shook hands. I got in the plane and flew to Saigon. Well, on the way out there, I thought, you know, Bill's right. I wonder how come I'm not so serene all the time. Because we had many members in AA, you probably have them here today, who say, if you were not happy all the time, you're not in the AA program. Oh, nonsense. But that's what they'll tell you. And I felt that I wasn't happy all the time, but I should be. Well, got out to Saigon, took me a couple months to get established, and finally I thought to myself, here I had a big book that Bill had given me, and the 12 steps and 12 traditions had given me, and I subscribed to Grapevine, came to me through an APO number, and so I was well indoctrinated with AA literature, went to AA meetings. I've been in AA meetings on every continent except Australia, all over the place. I even went to AA meetings in Iran. Now, there you get shot if you get drunk, you know. But I went to a meeting in Iran. This is when the Shah was the big shot there. I've been to meetings all over India and Bombay and Madras and Hong Kong and Singapore and Taipei and Kathmandu and all over Finland and Italy and Near East, all over the place, and AA meetings all over the place. Language, but I knew everything they were saying. I could tell by just sitting there. I got it into the skin, you know. Well, I was out there, I thought, well, as long as I'm out here, I know a little bit about the Christian religion. I didn't know much about the Jewish religion, but I knew a little bit of the Old Testament. And why don't I investigate, just for the fun of it, the Asian religions? Just see what, maybe I could get some help there. God, as you understand him, so I tried it. Well, I became rather knowledgeable in Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism and ancestral worship, the whole shebang. And I spent, on rest and relaxation periods during my years out there, I spent a lot of time in temples, the Buddhist temples and Hindu temples and all over the place, sitting as close as I could to the lotus position with my legs all crossed up like that. I couldn't quite make it, you know. And attempting to meditate. Now, meditation in the traditional way of hands together and thumbs together, saying, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, over and over and over again, didn't do a damn thing for me. I just couldn't make it. Well, maybe it does a lot for you folks, and I'm glad if it does, but to me it didn't do a damn thing. Well, after 2 or 3 years, I got more and more frantic. I was searching and searching and searching through these religions. I was going to AA meetings every place. Singapore, went to a great AA meeting. Bombay, great AA meeting. And I wanted to get that serenity. And I just got getting more and more frantic, and I was searching for it. Finally, one day, maybe 3 years had elapsed. I wasn't doing this all the time, of course, but rest and relaxation periods. I came to my little apartment in Saigon. I came in, and I just sagged to the floor. I was just beaten emotionally, and I lay on the floor there. And all of a sudden, I said to myself, oh, to hell with serenity. I don't care if I ever get it. And when I gave that up, you know what happened? I was totally serene. Searching is the trouble. If any of you are searching serenity, for God's sake, stop it. Be unserene. Know it. Then serenity will happen. But only when you accept it with your heart that you're not feeling good. This is who you are. They say, don't get resentful, you get drunk. Nonsense. The thing will get you drunk. Oh, it won't get you drunk. Is not recognizing that you are resentful. That's where you got to start. Faking it. I'm not resentful. Not resentful one bit, you know. I don't hate anybody at all. I love everybody, you know. That'll get you drunk quick, you know. I've never searched for anything since that time. The hell with it. That's the way. Now, they talk at AA about surrender. How long am I talking here? I'm talking too long. Better shut up. Am I talking too long?
No.
I'm not. Oh, all right. Should I tell you how I found God? Yeah? No, I'll tell you anyway. I'm not religious. I never have been, and not religious today to speak of. I'm afraid. I like the idea that there are religions, but I'm not there. And I was searching for God as I understood him early in my sobriety. I operated on a woman taking out a very large uterine tumor, and I had done this a good number of days before, and on this particular day I had taken out her sutures, given her instructions on what she should do when she went home, gave her an appointment to see me 6 weeks hence, and then I went back to my office, or to my office. That afternoon her husband called me, and he said, Dr. Marsh, I said, yes. He said, my name is so-and-so. I said, yes, so how do you do? Glad to talk to you. He said, I want to thank you very much for curing my wife. You have no idea how much we feel grateful we are to that. And so he and I passed the doctor-patient amenities. I said, well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be of assistance, and I'm glad so forth. And then he hung up. Then it rang through my heart what he had said. Thank you, doctor, for curing my wife. And I said, did I cure her? Did I? Now, I didn't underestimate my diagnostic ability. I had good diagnostic ability, still have. Did I underestimate my surgical ability?
No.
But did that cure her? I knew that if I had cut those stitches out, 48 to 72 hours after I'd put them in, the wound would have just gaped apart. And yet, I had taken the sutures out that morning, and the wound was tightly healed together. How come? What had happened? Well, I didn't know. I thought, well, maybe the nurses do it. You know, so I said, well, so they, after all, spend more time than I do with the patient, you know, except in the operating room. But I couldn't account, they didn't do it either. You know, I couldn't account for that. Finally, it became clear to me that inside of you and in me, there is a healing power. I had seen it 1,000 times in my patients. I'd cut my own hand and seen the thing get well in a few days. Something heals together. This to me became God. Why not? A healing power. You know, the word higher power is very appealing to many people. It makes no sense to me because it gives me, now this is my own bias, by the way, it makes me feel separate. Something's out there higher and I'm down here. To me, everything is God. That means there's nothing that isn't God. So, hello, God. I say, hello, God. Hello, God. Hello, God. Hello, God. It's all God to me. Well, it may not be to you, but it is to me. That's God. So that's what I did with my higher power. Surrender. Now, how do you surrender, and to what do you surrender? What do you surrender? Well, the idea of surrender is to give up your ego. But what is your ego? Can you find your ego? Try to find it sometime. You can't find it. There is no such thing as ego. It's a bunch of damned ideas. We think you should be, you ought to be, you have to be, you must be. That's what your ego is, and I'm right and you're wrong. That's your ego. Well, some of you are saying right now, that guy's crazy up there. You know, that's your ego talking. And what am I doing? I'm saying you're wrong, and that's my ego talking. We're ego-drenched. We're ego-drenched. And the idea is to surrender that ego because it stands in the way of unity. And that's, of course, what we desperately need. Well, surrender. How do you do it? You can't do it. You can't take the third step. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. You can't do that because the entity that would turn over your life and your will to something else is the ego, and that's the trouble to begin with. So what do you do? Well, I'll tell you. There are several ways that you can surrender. Let me tell you one that appeals to me the most. And that is, let's suppose I went to Don. Where's Don Pope? There's Don. Suppose I went to Don. Oh, the old man Popejoy. Suppose I went to him. Throw the hair out of your eyes, Don. All right, good. You can say that to me, by the way, too. Suppose I went to Don to tell him all of my troubles. And suppose Don, being an old-timer, just listened to me in order to understand. Just to understand what I'm trying to say. Spent his whole effort, whole heart and soul, whole devotion, energy, interest in listening to what I'm saying and attempt to understand what I'm trying to say. He would ask me many questions and I'd give him many answers and so forth. Now, as he did this, what would happen to me? I would say, that's the guy I've been looking for. My whole life, I wanted somebody who would hear me, not advise me, not pat me on the back, not scold me, just hear me. And Don is doing this. So I get revved up, and I think, I'm going to tell this guy more. So I tell him more of my troubles, and all of a sudden, what happens to Don? He says, you know, I've done this so many times before, being an old-timer, and I now see that as I listen to somebody, just to understand them, that they get turned on, and they tell me more. And I feel elated, and I tell him more. Now, most of us, by the way, let me just make a parenthetical statement here. Most of us listen to people, and as we listen, we look at them kind of dull-eyed, attempting, saying, acting as though we're listening, we aren't. We're saying to ourselves, where'd you get that crazy idea? What kind of a nut are you, you know? No, this is not listening. This is declaring war. Huh? So most of us go around declaring war. Oh, you're crazy. But I won't tell you. You're crazy. You're a nut. I can't, you know, the hell with you. So we don't listen, but Don is listening. And my heart and soul gets bubbled up, and his too. And the first thing you know, we're talking back and forth, and finally telling me things, and I'm listening, I'm taking it from him, I'm listening to him. And finally, our interest, our attention, our energy, and our devotion, they're all the same thing, by the way, become identical. They may start out separate, but slowly as we talk more and more, we're drawn closer together, as Bill and Bob were to begin with, and you're drawn together, and zip. At that point, there is no ego. There's only listening and understanding. It's at that point that healing happens. AA is very, and when you do that, There's a feeling of going up and you both transcend and you feel, wow, thank God I've been here. How many times have you gone to a meeting you didn't want to go to, and you went there and you shared with somebody, talked with somebody, came away feeling pretty good? You've zapped like that. AA is very aware of this. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women. Bill didn't write this, by the way. The first editor of the Grapevine wrote this preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. And Don is doing this to me, and we zapped. There is no ego then. Surrenders happen without your knowing. If you try to surrender, you're going to hang on to it. What you resist will persist. If you say, I'm not going to have an ego, I'm going to give up my ego, I'm resisting my ego, you know what, your ego gets stronger, it gets larger. Give it up, baby. You know, that's the point. You see, surrender is what it's about. Being who you are is what it's about. Developing your own program is what it's about, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe not as far as you're concerned. You have your own ideas. That's all right. Now, isn't that a glorious and a strange thing? How you and I can go to doctors who have helped us enormously in our recovery. Really, the doctors do a lot. And I'm not bragging about doctors because I am one. It's just true. But they can't give you and me the kind of sobriety that we demand. They can't do it. And psychiatrists, God rest their soul, you know. You can go to a psychiatrist and put you on couches and talk to you and all around. And they help us. They help us. But they don't give us the kind of sobriety we've got to have. And the men of the cloth, the ministers, the rabbis, the priests, and so forth, they're wonderful. And barring very few exceptions, they cannot give you and me the kind of sobriety that we've got to have. And what do? Well, here we collect a bunch of idealistic, perfectionistic, irritable, non-demanding, egocentric people, get them into a room together. You know, if you have 10 alcoholics out here in a circle, you've got 10 people all beginning with the sentences with the word I. All of them. And yet, with this very broken situation, we stay sober in the way we have to. What's going on? What kind of nonsense is this that these great men can't do it and we get together here and shoot off our big fat yaps and we stay sober in the way we have to? What's going on? Well, I suppose the doctors say, well, what you folks have is a very fine brand of psychosomatic medicine, or some other gibberish. Or the psychiatrist might say, what you have is a special brand of interpersonal benevolent relations. Well, maybe we do have. Or the men of the cloths, the rabbis, the ministers, the priests, would say, you have an esprit de corps that keeps you sober. But to me, it's the very essence of God. God bless you all.